Good morning. I would like to call the meeting of the Special Committee on Fisheries to please come to order. The time is 10:09 on Thursday, March 12, 2006. Members present are Representative Vance, Representative McCabe, Representative Elam, Representative Hemshute, and myself, Vice Chair Edgman, who will be sitting in awaiting the arrival of Chair Stutes, who has another engagement for a short while. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and the usual reminder, please silence your cell phones, and we're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table, and if you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of committee aide Kyle Newman, and he will be responsive. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the House Fisheries Committee Secretary, and Chloe Miller from the Juneau LIO for technology and teleconferencing support. Today's meeting will involve a presentation by Dr. Rob Campbell, the oceanographer and chief science officer at the Prince William Sound Science Center in Cordova. And committee staff Marnay Provost will advance the slides at the appropriate time. Dr. Campbell, if you can hear me, can you please put yourself and your affiliation on the record, please, and begin your presentation?
Certainly. My name is Rob Campbell. I'm an oceanographer and chief science officer at the Prince William Sound Science Center in Cordova.
Excellent. As we begin your presentation, I'd like to let members know that we do have an ample amount of time this morning, so please feel free to ask questions throughout the presentation, if that's fine with you, Dr. Campbell. And if you would, if you could please begin your presentation.
Certainly. Yeah, thank you very much for this opportunity. Representative Stutes had asked me to give you just a basic overview of our research, and this being the Fisheries Special Committee, I'm just going to mostly stick to fisheries and fisheries adjacent topics for you today. Next slide, please. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Dr. Campbell, and we also have the slides up. The slide up before us.
Okay. Can you advance to this slide of the Science Center?
Yes, I believe we have it in front of us.
Okay, excellent. It's a little difficult not being able to see it. Hopefully you've heard of the Science Center. Just a brief history. We came into being shortly after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. And we are a private nonprofit research center focused on Prince William Sound. We have something like 30 staff. Our numbers come and go as projects come and go. And we're focused on research in the region, outreach of our research, and we also have a large education component focused on K through grade in schools and elsewhere. The mission of the Science Center is to advance community resilience and the understanding and sustainable use of ecosystems. And so I'm going to talk to you today, like I said, about some of the fisheries and fisheries adjacent things that we do. Next slide, please. And I'm going to start with myself. I am an oceanographer. I do the basic monitoring in Prince William Sound, still funded by the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. We do that with vessel surveys. We go out about six times a year, kind of around the productivity season, and do all the basic oceanographic monitoring that you would expect. That's things like temperature, salinity, water clarity, oxygen, nutrients, and collecting samples for phytoplankton and zooplankton. So we call it the environmental drivers, the base of the food web. As well as the vessel surveys, we have a mooring that we put out in the central part of the sound each year. If you can click that panel on the right, it should hopefully do a little animation. That is a very, very simple robot. It's positively buoyant and wants to rise. So a couple times a day, it'll wake up and rise to the surface. And as it does that, it'll be measuring all the oceanographic things that that we need to measure: temperature, salinity, nutrients. Chlorophyll A fluorescence is a proxy of the amount of phytoplankton. So again, the base of the food web. It'll check in by itself and then pull itself back down to depth. Next slide, please.
Dr. Campbell, we didn't get weren't able to bring up the smaller slide and get it enlarged. We got your audio loud and clear, and I think what we'll do is we'll just continue to the next slide to keep abreast of your presentation.
Sure. Yeah. Are you working off of PowerPoint or the PDF of that?
A PowerPoint.
Okay. not a problem. So this slide is the kind of data that we get from that profiler. It gives us a really impressive picture of what's going on in the surface ocean over the course of the year. And I thought I would use this to maybe sneak in a little bit of oceanography 101 for you to give you an appreciation of how things work around here. So the top panel is temperature, salinity. Below that is proxy for phytoplankton biomass, and then below that is nutrients. And this is a range. This is kind of how like oceanographers like to look at depth specific data like this. So we have the surface at the top, and then deeper depths down below, and then we have time along the bottom. So this is just a representation of how things evolve over the course of the year in the surface of Prince William Sound. So if you give it a click, there should be a box up here. So we're starting off in the winter. Everything is well mixed. Temperatures are cold. It's quite salty. Not much phytoplankton and lots of nutrients. If you give it a click, we'll move into the time of the spring bloom. Basically, as the sun comes back in the spring. Oh, I'm getting a message here that the animations are not working. Is that the case?
Well, we do have the slide in front of us, and I don't know if on the slide which says PWS Surface Oceanography 2024, if there is we have the option of clicking any of those smaller boxes, because we do have the slide in front.
If clicking on it, there should be some boxes appear over top. Are you seeing those?
No, our screen has gotten dark as we tried. And I am not sure if we have the same version that you have there. It appears not.
It appears that we have the PDF version instead of an interactive one.
Yes. Our member with IT experience here at the table. Thank you. We do have the PDF version, I'm going to guess.
Okay. Then I won't worry about the animation.
And Dr. Campbell,
what this is showing.
Dr. Campbell, can I interject here? I think we do have our first question at the table.
Yeah, I think you were probably just about to say what I was going to ask. So basically, the box would move over, and we'd be able to see that in the summer, as we have more daylight, we're going to start to lose a little bit of the salinity, and then we get the fall freshwater influx. And so basically, the slide that we have that's a PDF that you would animate, you'd be able to move those boxes over and tell us about the changing conditions causing the interactions between each of those systems. Is that what this slide is showing us?
Yes. I can just do a quick overview with the animations. In temperature, obviously, we're seeing things warm up spring through summer, and that causes the surface layer to, that causes a surface layer to form. And so what happens is the phytoplankton get trapped near the surface where the sunlight is and where all the nutrients are. And that kicks off into what we call the spring bloom, which is a very fast, very big explosion of productivity in the surface of the ocean. And those phytoplankton actually use up all of the nutrients in the surface layer. So on that bottom panel of nutrients, you can see the cold color That is basically undetectable amounts of nutrients in the surface layer. And so we wind up in the summertime with this situation with the phytoplankton are down deeper where there are nutrients and still a little bit of sunlight getting through. And then moving into autumn and winter, we get the equinox weather, the return of storms, things start to mix up again. So really the thing to remember here is this tendency to form layers in the ocean and how that relates to the productivity of the phytoplankton at the base of the food web. Next slide.
And I might, Dr. Campbell, I might just note for the record that was Representative Hemshoot.
Oh, apologies.
Who I almost called Dr. Hemshoot.
By all
she
means.
Is advancing very quickly here at the table.
not Speaker Hemshoot. Thank you very much.
but we do, I did get a confirmation really quickly here that we are limited to using the PDF version of what you have there, Dr. Campbell. So we'll just do our best. And if you would please continue.
Sure. If you would go to the next slide. You can tell me what is on that slide because it adds some animation.
Yes, we have 2016 plankton camera.
Okay.
Slide five.
Slide five.
It's a little
okay. In 2016, we added a plankton camera to that profiler I told you about. I have a bunch of pictures here. This is presumably you're looking at one of them. So it is actually taking pictures of individual plankton as that profiler is moving through the water. And if you go to the next slide, that should be a picture of a bunch of different plankton. So we've gone through our images. There's millions and millions of them, and identified 43 different types of plankton. And we actually used machine vision AI to identify those plankton for us. So this is kind of what we're trying to move towards: is less going out in vessels and more having the profiler out there and doing things automatically and in near real time. If you'll go to the next slide.
Okay, we are back to having some technical difficulties on this end. And I'm going to use this as a maybe a departure point for a question or two, if there are any from committee members.
Oh, Representative Elam.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And so with this focusing on the Prince William Sound area, I was just curious, does this relate to also like the Resurrection Bay area where we have all of the plankton and food sources there? Or is this kind of similar to just or is this just focused on how it functions for Prince William Sound?
It's all connected. There's something called the Alaska Coastal Current that sets up well south in British Columbia and travels all the way up the coast. And then around us, there's the Copper River, which is the largest source of fresh water, adding to that. And that kind of all moves into Prince William Sound and continues along down the coast past Resurrection Bay, all the way past Cook Inlet and even into the Bering Sea.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Campbell, we have the slide with 43 classes of plankton before us. Did you advance the slide since then?
If we can move to the next slide.
Okay, we've got the state of the sound with the graphs in front of us.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I just thought I'd talk a little bit about how things are currently. And that top figure is just a demonstration of how we go from a temperature value and put it into more of a climatological context by turning it into an anomaly. And so that all those points are 20 years of observations. They're from Port Valdez. It was just the data I had handy. showing our seasonal cycle over the course of the year and variability we see from year to year. And so to put observations in context, we take a seasonal average, which is that black line through all of that data, and just subtract the observations, and that turns it into an anomaly, which is the departure from the average. So generally, we show things in red as warmer than average and blue as cooler than average. And so on the bottom, bottom panel there, I am showing temperature anomalies from central Prince William Sound. They're monthly averages, and they're at about 2 meters depth, so close to the surface. And this is a 50-year time series I've been able to put together from 1974 to the present. And so we have a long-term warming trend that we see basically everywhere, not quite a tenth of a degree per decade. And then, of course, our 2013-2014, we started seeing very strong positive anomalies, warmer than average. And this was Gulf of Alaska-wide, really. That happened for several years. It actually occurred in the winter. We had a very, very calm winter, so the winter storms were much farther to the south than usual. The ocean didn't mix up quite as much. And so we came into spring with a lot of residual heat into the ocean that was then added to and led to what we call the marine heat wave, colloquially known as the blob. In 2019, that happened again in August. So we had very calm weather and then a lot of heat going into the ocean on top of already a summer's worth of heat. And so that was actually even warmer than the original blob. And in Prince William Sound, things have continued to stay quite warm. And if you go to the next slide, I just have a list of impacts that we observed during those heat waves. Throughout Prince William Sound, also on the shelf, we saw a big change in type of plankton we were seeing. We started seeing the kind of plankton that you see off of Oregon and Washington. That plankton is generally a lot smaller and has a lot less lipid in it, so it's not as good food for fish. And then as a result of that, presumably we saw changes in forage fish, reductions in the amount, reduced growth. We had several recruitment failures in rather important fisheries like Pacific cod and crab. We had a massive die-off of seabirds, something like a million mirrors died at that time, as well as other seabirds. And in Prince William Sound specifically, we saw a real change in the number of whales we were seeing, whereas we would often have dozens of whales overwintering there. We went down to something like perhaps three. And something like a third of those whales have disappeared and do not appear to have turned up anywhere else. So presumably have probably died.
Before we advance, we do have a question on this slide.
Thank you. In combination of this slide and the previous slide, the state of the sound, it looks like the state of the sound is – that's what, about a 4 to 6 degree swing window temperature wise. And so I guess my question is, you know, 4 to 6 degrees doesn't really sound like much to me, unless of course my wife has the thermometer. But what does that do to plankton?
Right. It definitely changes who we see. Subarctic type plankton that we generally expect to see around here, we start to see a lot fewer of those. And it's kind of a, I'm not gonna call it a biological law, but different species have different thermal preferences, right? So when it is warmer, it is presumably more difficult for species that prefers cooler temperatures to do well. And as well, species that are more used to warmer temperatures, like those off Washington and Oregon, will start to do better. The same goes with salmon. In 2019, during that second heat wave, our temperatures in streams started to get into the temperature range that is considered lethal for salmon. And so we were in streams that didn't have any glacial impact. We were seeing like bright dead salmon because they simply couldn't make it up the rivers. Where the streams with glacial impacts were bankful and the salmon are doing fine because that water's cooler.
Thank you.
And Dr. Campbell, I think we do have full capabilities on this end now to track whatever you know might be on the slide that we didn't have before. So please feel free to proceed.
Okay. Yeah. If you can move to the next one, it should also say state of the town and have a little.
So I think we are in sync. We have state of the sound, cooling, and freshening and warming on both sides of the image.
Great. This was just to get across the idea that what we see in Prince William Sound specifically does depend a little bit on where we look. In the central part of the sound, out on the shelf, we are seeing sort of a generalized warming trend that we see throughout the Gulf of Alaska. But specifically in the western part of the sound, that's where all the ice sheets predominantly are. And the Gulf Coast in general is losing ice mass as fast as anywhere in the world, as fast as Greenland, as fast as Antarctica. And that meltwater is making its way into the ocean. And so we're actually seeing a cooling and a freshening trend on the western side of the sound, specifically at the surface. And that appears to be having an impact on overall productivity. And if you go to the next slide, that is a plot of the total amount of greenness in the ocean that has been observed by satellites. It's about a 25-year record. It's the best we have. And we're seeing about a third less over the last 2.5 decades. And that is presumably due to that warming and the meltwater entering into the surface of the ocean. As I mentioned, it forms layers. And so more heat and more fresh water appears to be making that surface layer a little bit thinner, which limits ultimately the amount of nutrients that are available to the ecosystem and causing an overall reduction in productivity. And this is something that we want. Yes.
Yes. I'm sorry to interject here, but, you know, just to stand back and sort of contextualize this, where else in Alaska do we have the opportunity to gather this kind of data? You know, I'm thinking in the Bering Sea, for example, and the continual discussions about the warming ocean conditions and the change in productivity and things like that. But that capability doesn't exist anywhere other than the realm of the science center that we're talking about today.
There's obviously lots of other oceanographers working in the state, and the traditional paradigm when I went to school is we go out in our ships a few times a year. Of course, nowadays with advances in robotics, that there are a lot of other ways to do it. But I'm not aware of anybody who's looking quite as closely at a patch of ocean as we are in Prince William Sound. And if you'll advance to the next slide.
Before we do that, we've got a question from Representative Vance, and I believe Representative Himshute. Representative Vance. Mm-hmm.
On this 30% decline in productivity, that's a very broad brush statement. Are we talking about in the ocean waters overall? Are we talking about specific species that's being impacted the most? Is that something that the Science Center has taken a look at? Because this is dramatic, and I'd like to better understand what you mean by 30% decline in productivity.
Great. Yeah, the prior plot, like I said, it's when we're estimating productivity with satellites, we are basically looking at the greenness of the ocean. That correlates quite well with the amount of phytoplankton that's there. So what that plot was showing was an overall decline in the amount of plankton biomass observed in Prince William Sound. We see it elsewhere over time. We have other measures of productivity, none quite as long as that. That's why I used that one. But we are also seeing it in our more direct measurements in the water of the amount of phytoplankton there. And even more recently, the amount of zooplankton as well. That's a shorter record still, something like 10 years. But it is something we are concerned about and want to be watching more closely. But it is the expectation. It's what you would expect from a thinning near-surface layer. If there's less overall nutrients available to the ecosystem, there's going to be less productivity as a consequence.
Follow up. Have you compared the volcanic activity and its impact in our oceans over the same period of time, and if there's any interface there? Because I've heard that volcanic ash feeds the zooplankton in the oceans as a nutrient, and wondering if there's any correlation to. We haven't seen any major eruptions in quite some time. And it's just a curiosity question. Not that I'm wanting to go cause any eruptions, but it's just a significant part of the system that I'm wondering if you've taken a look at.
Yes. Yeah. That's actually a really, really interesting thing about how the ecosystems work around here. And I've done a little bit of work on that myself. Way to think about it is near the coasts, the limiting nutrient in the ecosystem is nitrate, nitrogen. And that comes to us from deep water in the North Pacific. It's kind of a long story, but there's a 1,000-year conveyor belt of water that starts in the North Atlantic and Antarctica and travels all the way along the bottom of the Pacific Ocean and comes to us. And the whole time that water is moving our direction, there is stuff raining down from above. Everybody dies and everybody poops, basically. And so that water is just chock-a-block full of nutrients when it gets here to us. And through mixing, like our winter storms, it finds its way to the surface and fuels our really, really productive ecosystems. There is another limiting nutrient in the open ocean, and that is iron. And near the shore, there is lots and lots of iron. All of the fresh water that comes into the ocean from the margins, is chock-a-block full of iron. We get massive dust storms. We see them actually recently when we get these nice sunny days. We get a lot of winds from the land to the ocean that carries a lot of dust out into the ocean. And so that link between volcanoes and production, because when a volcano erupts, it injects a massive amount of iron and dust into the atmosphere that can travel out into the open ocean. But in Prince William Sound or Seward or anywhere near shore, there's lots and lots of iron available, so a volcanic eruption isn't really going to impact that.
Thank you.
Kind of long explanation, but hopefully helpful.
Yes, it was.
Representative Hemshute.
Thanks. Yeah, I just want to mention there's an absence of iron in the Southern Ocean, and I think there's speculation that it's tied to whaling. So back in the day when the whales were removed from the Antarctic Oceans, there's no land-based iron. So anyway, very interesting bird walk we could go down. But my question was more about the other observation. We have the federal observations like the Alaska Ocean Observing System and I was on a NOAA vessel for a period of time, and we were doing a CTD cast every time we stopped. We were checking salinity. And so there are long-term data sets, but I think what you were saying is your long-term data set is specific to your place, and it's very long-term. Well, very is relative, I guess, but for 20 plus years now, 25 years, more than that, you guys have been collecting the same data set locally. And so you're able to show trends that, like, the federal data sets are not as localized. So is that, or are the federal data sets different from what you're collecting?
It's a mix. That plot I had showed you of the temperature anomalies going back to the 70s, that is a mix of federal data. I basically went and looked for all of the data for the region that I could find. And so the early data is largely federal. It's actually when there was a lot of exploration for oil and gas. After the oil spill, there was obviously quite a lot of interest in pre-cleaned sound, so there's quite a lot of data from that. And then I've been doing this for almost 20 years myself, so then the newer data has been collected by me. We'll make use of any and all data that we can get our hands on, basically.
And quick
follow-up.
So thank you through the chair. Mm-hmm. I'm curious where the gaps are. And so I don't want to hold you back right now. We should just go through your presentation. But as we look at loss of productivity, this is impacting the entire state. And maybe you can't answer this, but it sounds like you guys are getting some great data for us in Prince William Sound. But where do we look for data in other places that are super productive places like Bristol Bay and Southeast? So anyway, I don't want to stop you, but if you do have a quick answer to the gaps, where are the gaps for decision makers who need to know what's happening in the oceans?
Sure. Yeah, if you can advance to the next slide, says next step, AMPER 2.0.
And we have it before us.
Yeah, oceanographers love acronyms. You got to have a cool acronym. So that would be Prince William Sound Autonomous Moored Profiler. We're actually, with help from Senator Murkowski, we were able to get a congressionally directed spending request in for some money to develop our own profiler. And so we're trying to do that with off-the-shelf parts. And ideally we would like to make these at scale and put them over the place. In oceanography right now, there are robot gliders that people use, but they cost something like $1,000 a day to use. And we would like to be able to build these profilers for a few thousand bucks so we could be putting them out throughout the state to be keeping a closer eye on, more specific parcels of water. if that answers your question.
Yeah.
Please continue.
And if you'll go to the next slide. Although I'm an oceanographer, you invariably get drawn into fisheries things in this state. And the AI that we developed for the profiler for the plankton camera, we tried it out on some salmon scales to see how well it could age them, and it was surprisingly good at it. So we were able to get a little bit of money from the North Pacific Research Board to have a closer look at that. So we took some scale cards from Sockeye, from the Copper River, Prince William Sound fishery. We developed a workflow to scan them with a microscope and an AI to automatically identify the scales and snip them out. And then we had five expert scale readers age those scales, and we used that information to train up AIs to see how they do. To go to the next slide. The short answer is that they're quite good at it. The table on the left is the accuracies. The machines are in red, and then the black are the humans. This is sort of the accuracy amongst the humans and the machines. And the machines are doing about as well as the humans do. The picture on the right is a way to look at what the AIs are using when they're aging the salmon scales. And the kind of cool thing is that they're figuring out by themselves to use the banding patterns on the scales the same way that the humans do to age the salmon scales. If you go to the next slide, the kind of dirty little secret about aging things from scales is it is quite subjective. And we were quite surprised at how variable the humans were amongst each other as well. And so these are called confusion matrices. They're showing the true class from consensus, like the most agreement amongst the human observers, versus what is predicted. And that is predicted by each of the five human readers and is predicted by the AIs. And so you want to see things on the center diagonal, the blue colors. More blue is it's doing well. And anything red on the outside, that is confusion. That's being wrong. And you can see that the humans can be pretty wrong a lot of the time. And the AIs are, again, doing about as well as the humans do. So our next steps are we're trying to develop scale scanners that can scan large numbers of scales very, very quickly. We've identified an archive of about 800,000 scales at a museum down at UW of high-sea salmon collections going back to the 1930s. And so we're hopefully going to figure out a way to scan all of those and continue to improve these models. And then if you go to the next slide, this was also animations. the next step with these AIs is we're working on in-stream cameras with onboard processors that can basically identify the fish in real time as they pass. We've also done some sonar work. For several years, we had a sonar camp in the Copper River down as close to the ocean as we could get. And that's actually paid for by the gill netters, with the idea being that if we just got one more opener in May, that would be about $1 million into the local economy. But the work with the stream cam is more to come up with a way to do what weirs do, but a lot more inexpensively. So we've developed the hardware and have developed the AIs that can identify the fish as they're passing. But we have a little bit more development work on the software side. But really the dream is instead of having weirs in streams would be to have a camera in there counting the fish as they pass and then sending an email to the fisheries manager at the end of the day saying, I passed 1,000 sockeye and 10,000 pinks today. So they would get that real-time information, but a lot more quickly.
Now this is
if you go to the next.
If I could just jump in, I'm from Bristol Bay where the water isn't as clear. So this is ideal for clear water conditions, right?
Yes. Generally, cameras are great for clear water streams, and then for highly curved ones, we use the sonars. That's what we use in the Copper as well. It looks like chocolate milk.
Yeah, yeah. Representative Vance?
Well, you mentioned the that you're developing this because this could transform the Cook Inlet. And there's a lot of speculation about, you know, the size of a jack, you know, going up the Kenai and the Kasilof. And there's been just a lot of consternation about the count and how far along, how much more time do you need to develop this? Because this is incredible. And I think Did you also say that it could be more affordable than a traditional weir?
Yes. Where to start? time is money, and I have not been able to find the money to get somebody working on finishing up developing that software. It's something we're actively looking for opportunities to develop. A weir costs something like $50,000 to $75,000 a year to run. You have to have people there. You need to feed them, all of that. Our systems are just off the shelf hardware, so you can build one for a few thousand bucks. And ideally, you'd be powering it either with solar or micro hydro, because you're in the stream already. So really, the cost would just be getting the data out. And in this day and age of satellite internet, that's actually pretty easy as well. Obviously, the idea is to have those real-time counts coming out. But the cool thing with the camera and the processor on board is you can actually keep an auditable record, so like an image of every fish that was identified. So if somebody wants to go back and check those counts, you can always do that.
Mr. Speaker, follow. I think it would be very prudent of us to see if it's worth investing in his work, find out if the department's already doing a similar measure, because this could issue a very quick return on investment based upon what we're already paying for weirs and the cost of this, but he needs help developing this. I don't know if department may be doing something similar, but this could give us some more clear answers that we've been looking for, and I would love to be able to follow up on this for next year's budget.
Well, thank you for those comments, and I totally agree. And this presentation, Dr. Campbell, and thank you for being here, and for Ms. Shimkoviak as well, who's in the audience, if there's any questions directed her way. But we are, darn it, running up to some time constraints with the top subject matter that could easily carry over a couple of sessions, and perhaps Chair Stutz would entertain that later on. But I think we're going to have to start economizing in order to get through all 35 slides. So, Dr. Campbell, wherever you feel like you can quickly go through a slide, please do that, and we'll do our best to get through and complete the meeting on time at 11:30.
Certainly. We've kind of gotten into the weeds on my stuff because the rest of the slides are definitely higher level, and I think we can go through them pretty quickly. If you can move to the herring research and monitoring. I'll basically go through what our other PIs are up to. So we've got Scott Pagaw here, who is leading our herring research and monitoring program. If you go to the next slide. The thing about herring is that it crashed shortly after the oil spill and has been at low levels ever since then. That's not unusual. Herring populations crash all the time. What's unusual is that they never really rebounded. And so we've been working on many levels of this for several years at this point. If you go to the next slide, just an example of some of the projects we've been working on. We've been doing various surveys of adults, juveniles from sea and from air. We've done tagging studies. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a bit. We're looking at interactions between herring and salmon. I'll talk more about that in a bit. And also tracking disease prevalence. And really the lack of recovery is, as you'd expect, a mix of several factors. If you go to the slide labeled herring recovery, disease was a major issue, as was predation for a time. We had a really huge number of whales in Prince William Sound that were consuming a large proportion of herring biomass every year. Since the blob heat wave, that obviously is not the case. But we are still hovering right at basically replacement, which is that green line there. And for us to see recovery, we're going to need to see more recruitment. But as I said before, the lack of a reduction in overall ecosystem productivity is concerning for herring recovery as well. If you go to the next slide, that is Pete Rand. He is a fisheries ecologist here at the Science Center. If you go to the next slide, Pete and I are working on a project looking at the interactions between salmon and herring. And they're quite complicated. That's what this slide is meant to show. They're sometimes competitors, sometimes predators. So we've documented that pink salmon molts consume larval herring. Larger herring can also consume pink salmon smolts, and they compete for plankton prey. So we're trying to tease apart all of these various interactions. This is a pretty new project. If you go to the next slide, we're actually modeling this on the cecum surveys that the state of Alaska does in the southeast, which is actually used for predicting pink salmon returns. But we're working in the southwest part of Prince William Sound, sampling herring and pink salmon as they're exiting the sound, and looking at those predatory and competitive interactions. If you go to the next slide, Pete is also doing a lot of work in the Copper River specifically. The size of Copper River salmon as they're returning is getting smaller and smaller. That's happening statewide. It's not just sockeye. We especially see it in Chinook, but really are seeing it in all species. And that's just a consequence of warming. And so that has implications for the spawning migration that Copper River fish do. They do one of the longer migrations of salmon. And so smaller fish have less lipid. But if you go to the next slide, that's actually just a shout out to a workshop that Pete held last month. We had basically people from all over the watershed come to Cordova and talk about how things are changing and how we are expecting things to change over the next 100 years. But if you go to the next slide, Pete is also doing a lot of work in the watershed on how things are changing. He's doing tagging studies to look at migration success by the salmon. They're measuring lipids in those fish to see how that's changing and how that is impacting their ability to do their return migration. If you go to the next slide, they're also doing tagging studies with smolts and looking at their outward migration, because we know very, very little about that in the Copper River specifically, anything about their timing or how well they're making their way out into the ocean. So go to the next slide. That is Rao Giganti. He's pretty new to the Science Center. He is our director of omics. He does genomics, metabolomics, proteomics, you name it. Rao is using some of his tools in his toolbox to look at the molecular basis of that reduction in size and lipid in the returning fish. Obviously quite a lot going on in here. And also tracking the impacts of pathogens on the fish as well. If you go to the next slide, that's Marianne Bishop. Marianne is a bird ecologist and a fish ecologist. Sticking just to the fisheries type thing, she's done a lot of tagging work in Prince William Sound. And if you'll go to the next slide with the map on it, we currently have an array of tag listening devices that have completely curtained off Prince William Sound. And so they have a range of about 700 feet. So we have a listener every 700 feet in Hinchinbrook Entrance, Montague Strait, and the passes. And so any tagged fish, shark, you name it, that passes by there will get registered by that array. We'll know that they've come or gone. And we've used that for a number of species. If you go to the next slide, like lingcod, peacod, rockfish, and even herring. And most recently, we actually had a oceanographic glider, basically a robot, traveling through Prince William Sound with a listening device on it, trying to find out where herring were spending their time. And if you go to the next slide, that is Marisha, who is in the room today. And the next slide is from her. Marisha is our newest addition to the Science Center. She just started in January, coming to us from NOAA. Marisha is a social scientist who has a lot of interests in fisheries topics. Is she there? I will maybe let her talk to it if she'd like.
Yes, if we could. Marisha, do you want to come to the table, please, if you would? I very much appreciate you being here. You can put yourself on the record.
Bring an assistant, too.
I did, yeah. For the record, my name is Marisha Shimkoviak, and I am the Director of Coastal Resilience at the Prince William Sound Science Center. As Rob noted, I just started there in January after 10 years with the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, and my work is evolving, but it is really centered around putting pieces of resilience together for our fishing communities. Honestly, I think it reflects a lot of what the Seafood Task Force has sort of illuminated through the legislature as initiatives that we need to put forward. As one of the last things I did with NOAA, I developed a Gulf-wide fisheries planning framework with Cordova, Sitka, and Kodiak. So that was a three-year initiative in which we worked with the communities to develop localized resilience plans for those communities, focusing on fisheries as sort of the anchor of those communities. And then the link there is for bringing those plans together in a Gulf-wide sort of framework. And it touches on all the things that you see there in the cogwheel, again, reflecting what the state legislature's work put together as well. And now part of my switch to the Prince William Sound Science Center is really intended to implement some of these things, actualize them, and then track their success over time. So I'm building a portfolio to try to do that. And one of the first things in that is I'm leading a project with Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, which is based out of Sitka, but represents longline and other fishermen across the state, to do a seafood energy and innovation planning project, really honestly focusing on where we can build efficiencies into the system right now. And yeah, I can probably just stop there.
Well, I think your line of work is absolutely fascinating. And I'm sitting here thinking of the literal sort of definition of resilience. But from your perspective, how would you, as a social scientist, and I guess maybe more access on the scientist part, define the term resiliency?
Yeah, I mean, I think classically resilience is probably how, how you would think about it, right? Which is a responsiveness to a shock and then going back to sort of that steady state. I think when we talk to communities about that, it is... When you talk to fishermen, right, it's about continuing to be able to fish. It's about being able to pass on fishing knowledge throughout generations, to be able to have that be a mode of operating for their sons and daughters. But it's not, you know, when you sort of talk more widely within the community, it's about Alaska also sort of being at the front lines of blue economy, right? Expansion. So it's about mariculture. It's about MCDR. It's about the work that Rob has been presenting on, which is, you know, high tech. How do we sort of meet this the state of volatility and our human capital constraints, right, in Alaska with tech? And so we need to sort of evolve and be ready to be at the front lines of that change. And I think for in terms of what resilience looks like for our communities, I think it's about keeping fisheries at the core, but also being able to, you know, bring in all these different tech options and AI and educate our, you know, our youth and our workforce to be able to meet those needs and evolve and be on the front lines, I think, of change for the nation. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that response. And we do, we're a little bit now ahead of the curve in terms of our slide deck. So we do have ample time for questions. Representative Hemshoot, if there are others as well.
Oh, I probably have a lot of questions. I just want to start with one that's top of mind for me, though. And in my region in Southeast, I represent House District 2, which includes Sitka. I'm very concerned about invasive species, specifically green crabs. So is the center in Prince William Sound monitoring or looking at, and for you guys, it may be other things. I don't know where all the Elodia is, if that would, you know, freshwater systems interact with what you do, but I don't know that you'd monitor those exactly, or pike or any of that. But is there any part of your center that's looking at invasive species?
I will defer to Rob on that, since that's out of the social science.
Yes, we have not had any green crab documented up here yet, but Rao Chiganti, it's on his radar. He has been looking for opportunities to work on eDNA monitoring for green crab. It turns out it's very difficult to work with them because you don't want to inadvertently introduce them somewhere. So he was looking at trying to do that down in Washington, where they're already well established. But it is very much on our radar as well.
Thank you.
Follow up. Additional questions, Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So I'm really interested in the sort of the juxtaposition of the new tech. You mentioned tech. Doctor also mentioned tech about replacing weirs and how that would interface with your idea of resilience for fisheries recovery and that sort of thing. If we had the opportunity at some point to put money into a program that could help with that, I mean, how would we know? I mean, are you working on anything in that realm, in the technology for, I don't know, even know how to frame this question, but I think the two of them are kind of interesting together, really.
Mm-hmm. Rob, I'm going to defer to you in a second here, I think, and because both Rob and Rao's work, I think, interfaces in this in terms of the center trying to find, like, low investment solutions, right, that are scalable within Alaska. Because one of the things that we're facing is that if the tech costs too much, right, and we already sort of have a certain amount of inertia in the things that we've invested in to monitor things, then you can't, your sort of willingness to invest in the tech is then sort of not. But I will say that, you know, as you all know, all of our communities are so highly invested in salmon, Cordova especially, but even in Southeast and obviously in Bristol Bay, that looking for solutions in the salmon space, I think, are, you know, something that came up throughout our Gulf-wide planning effort, right? They are, you know, they are the reason we are called the salmon state to some folks, right? And I think without salmon anchoring our communities, were our participation in fisheries, I'm not sure what that's going to look like into the future. But Rob, I'll defer to you on sort of the investments in the science space on that.
Sure. Yeah. The basic thinking is knowledge is power. The managers need information to effectively manage the fisheries. Like I've mentioned, our sonar project in Copper River, the state has a sonar weir of its own, but it's about 40 river miles up the river from the ocean. And so they're counting the fish several days after they've left the ocean and aren't available to the fishery. And so the fishermen were very worried that they were missing out on opportunities. So that's where we came in. They actually paid about not that much money, like $40,000, $50,000 a year, for us to put some sonars lower down in the river as close as we could to the ocean to give the fisheries manager that faster information, so he would be better able to decide whether or not they could go fishing. And that's true for the weir idea. Like, weir projects keep getting canceled throughout the state because they're expensive. So the idea is that if we can do it better, faster, cheaper, we'll be able to get that information into the hands of the people who need it to make those calls on the fisheries.
Hello. And before we go to the follow-up, we'd like to welcome Chair Stutes back. Appreciate you allowing me to pinch hit,
I
guess I will continue to do until we finish the meeting, which isn't a whole lot longer. But just for the record to note that Representative Stutes arrived at 11:08 a.m. And was there a follow-up?
Yeah, mostly just a comment. I appreciate that, Robin. I think that Representative Vance had a really good point. If we can do, and the fishermen that are saying 40 miles upstream maybe is the wrong place that, I've talked to the DOT about car counters and where they put car counters sort of defines the issue. And maybe if we can do something cheaper up closer for those fishermen, that would be a really great idea. So I kind of agree, actually. That.
All right, we've got about 20 some odd minutes left, and I think we are essentially through the slide deck. So entertaining questions at large, I suppose. Representative Hemshute.
Thanks. I don't have a lot more to ask. I just have, I guess, two questions. One is, how do the data that you're collecting through the center interact with Fish and Game and the decisions that they make? And then to Ms. I'm going to be able to say this. Hang on. Shimkoviak. All right. I was getting there. Can you talk more about what you're doing with Alpha and the seafood energy and innovation? Like, what is that? What are you looking at there? So two questions, I guess, maybe for two different people.
Okay. I'll start through the chair. So you're probably familiar with some of Alpha's work in this space. They just successfully transitioned, they hybridized a diesel engine. So now we have the first diesel electric commercial fishing vessel in the nation is in Alaska. And they are transitioning another one called the Energizer, appropriately. And so we will have two hybrid electric commercial fishing vessels. And they did, in the past, they did a lot of work with AFDF, so the Alaska Fishermen's Development Foundation or Fisheries Development Foundation, and Sea Grant to sort of come up with low-hanging fruit on energy efficiency for fishing vessels, you know, so scrubbing their hull and that kind of thing. And so as part of sort of this trajectory, they applied for CDS funding to do a sort of broader planning initiative in seafood for energy innovation and efficiency. And they asked me to lead that project, but it's with Chandler Kemp at UIF, who's an energy expert, and Linda Benkin at Alpha. And then we have a steering committee of processor representatives and fishing vessel folks and hatcheries and workforce development. And the intent, it's a two-year project that we just initiated, and the intent is at the end of 2 years to have a plan that touches on Sitka, Yakutat, and Cordova, but again, sort of has this capacity to be adopted on a wider level that looks at ways of reducing energy costs within seafood. So I think the lowest hanging fruit there at this point is going to be within the processing sector. So mechanisms there and across different time frames, across different investment levels, but we're hoping to touch on maybe hatcheries as well. And then, you know, sort of look forward looking about how do we get to sort of broader transitions? How do we implement some of these energy efficiency schemes? And what does our workforce have to look like in that space as we try to move forward with those initiatives? So look for that in 2 years.
And the other question through the chair was to Dr. Campbell about how the data collected at the Science Center interacts with decision makers, managers at Fish and Game.
Right. Most of the data we collect is made publicly available pretty quickly, but a lot of it is not currently used by the state. A lot of the fisheries management is that doesn't incorporate environmental data. On the federal side, there's more of a push to do that, and things like ecosystem-based management. And so NOAA puts together an ecosystem status report every year, and we contribute to that. But part of the problem is just the time it takes to get that data. Like when we go out in our boat and collect plankton, it takes us about a year to get through those samples. So we're really far behind the curve. So that's why we're working, again, with the tech, things like profilers with cameras on them that could give us that kind of real-time picture. So that the dream would be able to say within the year, oh, this is looking like a low productivity year, or this is looking like a high productivity year. But we're not quite there yet, and the fisheries management community is still working on incorporating that kind of data.
Any additional comments or questions? If we have a few minutes, Representative Stutes, I know Cordova is in your district, and I had the pleasure of being at the center with a group presentation back in June, and we do have longtime resident and fisherman and lobbyist Jerry McCune here in the audience as well. But the story behind the creation of the center itself, I found really fascinating. And, you know, today's presentation kind of gives us a glimpse of how groundbreaking the center is going to be in time in terms of its cutting edge technology and the research and the monitoring capabilities and really leading the charge and understanding the ocean environment so much better. But, and as Ms. Shimkoviak has been describing, really, you know, making it a more integral part of the life cycle of the people around the Gulf, and hopefully, you know, be a precursor, the Science Center, to other things around the coast of Alaska. But, you know, just the story of this Science Center and its creation, I found really compelling because it was a community-wide effort to put the center together, if I recall correctly, with a lot of funding, donor sources, you know, being local outside the region. But it was really neat in that the community made it happen, you know, in the aftermath of, you know, what happened back in 1989 and the spill and all the impacts of the great big black box, as we call the ocean, over on our side of Alaska and Southwest, where we know far less and really don't have the capabilities of having this Marine Science Center in place. And Representative Chair Stutes, I don't know if you wanted to.
Oh, no, it's a great facility. I think we should have a fisheries trip down to Cordova, frankly.
Dr. Campbell, I don't know. I don't know if I had the pleasure of meeting you during that visit last June. But if you wanted to maybe just spend a minute or two and talk about the creation of the Science Center, maybe the vision behind it, before we wrap things up this morning, I think the committee might appreciate that.
Sure. Yeah. It really did come about as a result of the Exxon Valdez. There had been talk about it beforehand, but within days of the spill, they had incorporated us, and it was a mix of chilly local people, fishermen. Dee Treadwell was in town at the time. He was one of our founders. I'm not really doing this story justice.
Well, I appreciate that, and maybe it's something we can come back to, but I would really underscore what the chair just said, and that is if we get the opportunity to come to Cordova, go to Cordova, please take advantage of it, because it's a very – I found the community as a whole being cutting edge, and I threatened the chair that Cordova might be in my district in the future, and she said absolutely not.
Right. Well, they claimed that. Well, and you have to give the I guess you would call her the executive director, Katrina, due credit. I mean, she was like a bulldog and a pant leg, and she was not going to stand for anything less than moving forward with this project, because it was out on a dock that was literally falling in, and they were working out there, and it was just, it was almost dangerous to go out and visit them. But she had this vision of this center, and it's right across from a bay. It's just incredible. And you think I was joking when I said we ought to take a trip down there, but it would be well worth it, truly.
Representative Fans.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm always seeking the solutions on how we can do better moving forward, and we've heard from different science centers and research. But I think this committee should pursue how we can encourage the shared research and integration with the department. Most Alaskans interface with the department and are unaware of the incredible research that's happening and the solutions that our managers could have. The Board of Fish, you know, they need these the full picture, and I feel like Alaskans are missing out on it. Just the picture that we saw of this change in the size of the fish in the Copper River alone. People think that the shrinking size of the salmon is due to management, but it's so much more than that. And I wonder if there is a way that we could help guide partnership with all of the research that's happening in the department and help open lines of communication. I don't know how we would do that, but I think that's something that's needed moving forward, because there's so many changes, and the state of our salmon is now an Alaskan concern, not just a coastal concern. And there has to be a way that we can build the communication and the understanding of the science that is happening and open up the lines of communication across the regions, because I feel like a lot of the information is siloed and is not really being fully integrated into our overall statewide fisheries management. So whatever we can do, I want to help push that forward. And thank you for continuing that work. I know that that's kind of part of what you're doing in the smaller communities, but we need something to happen statewide, because I don't feel like the message is getting out.
Chair Stutes.
Thank you. Speaker Edgman. Well, it was really along those very lines, Representative Vance. It was very encouraging when we had the presentation from BBSRI to hear how they work collaboratively with the department and how they shared the information and how facilitating the department actually was, as opposed to debilitating. So this is the same thing. So I appreciate what you were saying.
additional comments or questions in our remaining few minutes from committee members? Seeing or hearing none, thank you, Dr. Campbell. Thank you, Ms. Shimkoviak. Very much appreciate this presentation. It feels like we have, again, to go back to the term glimpse, we've just, you know, been able to get a little bit of taste of what's going on, and it's really, really exciting and look forward to in the coming years hearing from the Science Center and its future work. At this point, next week's schedule is being worked on, and it will be emailed out to members as soon as it's finalized. And with that, seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 11:24 a.m.